You're listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. We bring expertise on international affairs from Stanford's campus straight to you. I'm Michael McFaul, host of World Class and director of the Freeman Spogli Institute. The battle between religion and secular views has become increasingly heated in today's society, both in the United States and around the world. Some people see religion as an irrational, outdated way of looking at the world. But is it? To help us understand the conflict between religion and rationality and how it affects our political discourse, we're speaking today with Professor Dan Edelstein. He is Stanford's William H. Bonsall Professor of French and Chair of the Division of Literatures, Culture, and Languages, and an affiliate of the Europe Center here at FSI. Dan, welcome to World Class.
Great to be here.
So this is a big topic. This is not our normal world-class topic. So we're going to start big and then we're going to move around. But let's start with the fundamental question. Are human beings rational?
Well, I think it's quite fair to say that not only human beings are rational, but even many animals show basic signs of rationality. They understand the principles of cause and effect and behave in ways that we would generally consider rational even for humans.
So why is there religion then? How does that fit with a basic sense that we're rational and yet we have these religious beliefs that seem, well, you tell me, are they maybe they are rational. Maybe they serve a rational purpose.
Well, one of my favorite anthropologists, Claude Lévi-Strauss, had the theory that really in terms of rationality, there's not much that distinguishes so-called primitive myths and advanced science, the kinds of mental processes are very similar. We see the same, you know, human reason at work, but we're working with very different premises. And I think that's probably one of the big confusions that occurs when we're thinking about this, you know, supposed clash between reason and rationality, which is that the real clash is about what's our starting point.
Okay.
What are our premises? And not so much how then do we think about those premises?
Say more about that. So what would be some examples of starting premises that might be different?
Well, you could go all the way back to the sort of great clash around the question of heliocentrism in the 17th century. So when
tell our listeners what that word
so
means.
This
That's
is
a big word.
This is a theory that the Earth revolves around the sun rather
right.
than the sun revolving around the Earth. And the famous trial of Galileo in the 17th century was precisely on this question. And it's a bit ironic, and I think the church gets a bit of a bad rap in this story because, in fact, the Catholic Church had been a great sponsor of, you know, scientific research up until this point.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, well, so this is why in lots of churches you have meridians.
Right.
Galileo himself was closely working with various cardinals, but then they hit this problem of a premise, which is it's a kind of a big problem for certain parts of Catholic theology to displace the Earth as the center of the universe. So they were totally fine with the measurements, you know, when Galileo's dropping things off the Tower of Pisa, and the method part they had no trouble with. But when you hit the basic premises, that's when you get friction.
Okay, well, if we fast forward to some of our political debates today, give us some I don't want to make any presumptions here, but do you see a similar situation where initial premises lead to a clash between what some people call science and others call beliefs?
I think there's pretty much all of the hot button topics probably revolve around this. So take abortion. It really comes down to the premise of when does life or some kind of conscious life begin. I think that one of the reasons that's such a sticky topic is that it's not like evolution or heliocentrism where there really is a clear answer and that you have to be pretty much obfuscate the facts to believe the opposite. You know, in the case of human development, there's a lot we don't really know. I mean, we don't know what the experience of, you know, being an embryo is. And I think that's why it's difficult to really make much headway on that question because no one can really prove that their premise is better than the other.
Interesting. Well, what about like climate change? So lots of scientists I know have worked on climate change. They say the evidence is not refutable. And yet politicians, our president, for sure, President Trump, says, you know, he refutes that. And when I hear him say that, that sounds irrational to me. Mm-hmm. Is that irrational or is that just a different premise?
Well, I think that one could probably – so there's, I guess, two sides of rationality, right? One would be how are you reasoning? This is sort of what Descartes gets at when he's describing method. So what is
tell the way – listeners who he is.
Oh, so René Descartes, another important 17th century philosopher, yep. writes a book called The Discourse on Method. And his basic point is, you know, the reason we disagree so much is that we're not reasoning in a methodical way. And so mm-hmm. people sort of have faulty reasoning along the way. They make false syllogisms, for instance. So they're not reasoning logically. Okay. Now, that's one problem with rationality that can occur. The other is, at what point do you have to question your premises? So when you have enough evidence, do you start rethinking what the philosophers would call their priors? You know, what's your prior assumption?
Right.
And I think that's really a piece of rationality that emerges with the scientific revolution in the 17th century. So it's like the empirical turn.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We're just getting all this data. Oh, it's forcing us to rethink what we had believed previously. So I think that
if you don't rethink, does that make you irrational? If there's a preponderance of data that says, you know, your priors were wrong, is that then when we can call somebody irrational? And I'm thinking of the climate change.
Yeah, yeah. I think that, you know, it's sort of how we would use the term in common language also,
uh-huh.
right? You know, you're right. being irrational. You know, everything points that you're wrong. We
right.
have all this evidence, but you are insisting in a stubborn way against it. I mean, I think what your question gets at that I find really interesting is that there's a kind of parallel maybe between certain kinds of religious irrationality, sort of believing
right.
that despite all evidence, the earth is only 6,000 years old, and sort of maybe a more ideological irrationality, which you know, you find just as much, you know, with the Soviets
right.
who were not at all religious.
Right. But ideological, that's an interesting word. Well, if we think about these new wave of politics, especially in Europe and also I would say in America, but you know, we've had a rise of these, I don't even like the word populist, but they're commonly referred to as populists. They have this kind of resistance to the liberal international order. And they also claim to be more religious. And most certainly a country that I used to live in, Russia, that's an argument that Vladimir Putin makes all the time. He says his rejection of what I would call liberal and even rational kinds of outcomes with respect to markets or social policy is anti-religion, and he's appealing to people's religious faith to mobilize them. Is that a phenomenon you see across Europe, or is that just it kind of depends on what country we're talking about? And if so, why do you think it's happening
mm-hmm.
now?
Yeah, so I think you get something similar in Poland and Hungary as well.
Okay.
Interestingly, though, the populist movements that we're seeing currently in Italy, Germany, France, there the religious part is less evident. I think if you
I didn't know that.
You
That's
could probably, yeah. I mean, in Italy, I'd say it's very, I mean, especially with the Cinque Stelle, who are probably the most populist.
This is the five-star
movement. The five-star movement. They have right. a kind of, you know, more technocratic, slightly authoritarian bent. I mean, they're hard to pin down. I mean, I think what I was just reading, the demands of the French Yellow Vests this morning.
Tell our listeners about that, just so they
know.
So
this is, like, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, this real, you know, resistance movement emerged in France. Fits into these populist
right.
movements,
right.
you know, in air quotes, that we've been seeing across Europe, and really took everyone by surprise, just how quickly they mobilized, the sort of extent of the anger. And they finally published a list of their demands. And it's interesting because if you read each one of the demands alone, I wouldn't say that any single one is irrational. But taken together, they don't really form a coherent political agenda. And I think that's maybe where religion can come in and be very useful, that religion might be helpful for covering over some inconsistencies that would exist. So you could have a kind of nationalist, but also maybe at times socialist and hopefully not national socialist agenda.
Well, let's hope that for sure. But that's interesting. So you don't think there's a general pattern in Europe then? You think each different country brings together a different set of coalitions and a different set of ideologies? That's the right way for us to – we should be wary of these sweeping theories.
Well, I don't think that religion plays the same role in all
right.
of them.
Okay.
But I do think – I think there probably is a pattern that one could detect here. And it does seem, as you were saying, to be a real response to what's viewed as a liberal global elite that has left behind, you know, much of the population in these countries.
And it could or could not be related to religious ideas.
Yeah, and maybe there's also religion can become a stand-in for other signifiers like culture, ethnicity, race. You know, if you're talking about a Christian Europe, that really means we don't want all of those Arab Muslims coming in.
And is it always the case that leaders that invoke religious values are conservative?
It's not always the case, not at all. And I think, I mean, this is where having a historical perspective is helpful.
Yeah.
It's actually pretty hard to read the Gospels and come away thinking that, you know, Jesus Christ was advancing
a kind of conservative
economic arguments. So there have been over time lots of sort of left Christians who have challenged business interests precisely in the name of the gospel. I mean, I think that if today there seems to be somewhat of a polarization of, you know, left secularism versus right religiosity, it sort of gets back to those cultural questions we were talking about before. I mean, I think in the States, it's really after Roe v. Wade, in a way, that religion became so polarized. And it's not because of economic issues. So like the traditional division of politics on that spectrum.
Oh, that's interesting. That was the moment.
I think it's one of the key moments. And gay rights has been another one.
Right. So there's material to be used, but it's not necessary. It's just that. There are also for other kinds of ideas, left or progressive, you could easily find those in the Christian tradition as well.
Yeah, and I think that it's so when Alexis de Tocqueville talks about religion in America, he believes that it's
another 19th century guy. Just footnotes.
Democracy in America.
Yes.
So he comes from France, which is a very Catholic country, but it's a very, you know, it has a kind of state Catholicism in the 19th century. And he looks at the role of religion in America, which is at the time really the only large democracy in the world. So it's a kind of fascinating object to be studying. And he thinks that religion is key in maintaining America as a democratic state, precisely because it gives something else than individual material well-being as a goal. What's interesting, fast-forwarding to the present, is seeing how much of the evangelical movement has sort of given up on sort of this broader social good and sort of what, you know, I think could be described as a more traditional message of the Gospels, in order to defend individual self-wealth, really. You know, the whole prosperity gospel is a fascinating reversal of what Tocqueville recommended religion as.
And with most of those groups, that is a core belief, right, about the individual self.
Yeah, it's also kind of a weird reversal of Calvinism, right? That for Calvin, you never really knew if you were going to be saved because it was totally up to God. And therefore, you had to always look for little signs, which were usually signs that you were a really holy person. And now with the prosperity gospel, the signs are that if you're going to be saved, well, God's also going to make you filthy rich beforehand. And so money bizarrely stands in for, you know, your fate after death.
Interesting. Is that a phrase, prosperity gospel, in your world? Is that
Well, not so much in my world. It's one I feel like I've heard.
I've never heard that. That's a great phrase. Well, let's come back to this rationality piece with religion. You know, maybe this is just my naive living in a bubble kind of world that I do at Stanford. But, you know, democratic institutions, and you invoked the Soviets before, we always thought that we had this superior political system that was based on deliberation, expression of the majority, that would lead to kind of best outcomes. And the Soviet command autocracy would lead to irrational outcomes, like you said. And most certainly, as somebody who'd lived in the Soviet Union, that seemed to be the case in terms of economic things. It seems today that those same liberal democratic institutions that we thought were producing prosperity and greater freedom have either been hijacked or have been eroded to much more irrational arguments and irrational leaders. Is that accurate? And how worried are you are about it? Or will we come back to an equilibrium and we should just all mellow out? And some of the most extreme writers in this way, because you invoked National Socialist a few minutes ago, worry about a guy like Trump or a guy like Mr. Orban, President Orban in Hungary, that these are proto-populist leaders appealing to emotion as opposed to rational arguments that in the end might erode liberal democracy. Where do you come out on that? That's a mouthful, I know, but.
Well, I think that after the Cold War, we became a little too complacent about liberal democracy. And there was this growing sense that it was the only game in town. All the other options were off the table. And that there it was kind of the natural conclusion. I mean, as your colleague.
Right. End of history.
End Frank of history, Fukuyama, right? Yes. That this is where we've been going all along and we're finally there. And I think pretty much everyone, including Frank Fukuyama, has now backtracked on that.
Yes.
And realize,
his latest book is about identity, so it's very different. We've had him on the show, in fact,
Right, so now that I think people recognize you can't take it for granted and, you know, go back to, you know, some of the more classical ideas of political thought, someone like Polybius and other Greek thinkers.
Help our listeners understand that. I'm loving this. Polybius. I don't even know who Polybius is.
So Polybius is he's a fascinating guy. He was a Greek hostage in Rome around towards the end of the Punic Wars. He actually witnessed the sacking of Carthage.
Wow.
And then he writes the histories of the Punic War. And in the middle, he has a whole theory of how every state eventually has a flaw and that flaw will lead to the collapse of one form of government. So the flaw of a monarchy is that doesn't leave room for the other individuals who feel like they have a lot of honor. And so eventually you get an aristocracy, but that leaves out all the other people in the state who don't have a say. And so then it leads to a democracy. And so you get this cycle, and anacyclosis is the word he uses. Interestingly, it's translated as revolution. And so for him, the goal is you have to stop this horrible cycle.
Right.
And you do that with mixed government. So this is why someone like Adams liked Polybius so much. But I think that what the ancients recognized is that history doesn't go in a straight line and that, you know, we're probably always hopefully not fully tilting over into another regime.
Right.
But that it's not going to be this stable way forward.
Right.
So I'm worried as well for very much the reasons you said. On the other hand, maybe we also need to sort of develop a theory that allows for a little bit of wobbling in how we think about states and then think about ways in which we can prevent those
from going too far.
Yeah, exactly.
What would be the first step towards that?
Well, maybe to tie it in with our discussion, it seems like a lot of the so-called populist rage right now comes from a sense of misunderstanding that, you know, here we are, as you say, in our Stanford bubble talking about liberal democracy and, you know, a couple hundred miles away, there's a sense that we don't really have much in common anymore with other people. I think religion might be part of that. The way in which at universities in particular, we sort of think about religious people, prayer people, you know, we have almost a hard time wrapping our heads around their very lives. And, you know, maybe one thing we can do, and I'm not trying to say like we have to go there and like make the Trump voters feel good about themselves or about their racism. I think there's some seriously, you know, bad ideas that some people have out there and we shouldn't condone them. But, you know, maybe recognizing the fascinating, you know, rationality in things like theology,
right,
understanding religious discourse will also help us you know, bridge that gap and, you know, speak to them, have them feel like maybe we can find a common language would be one step.
I love that. Dan, I think you got to go on the road.
Amen.
Bozeman, Montana, Oklahoma City, Kansas City. These are some of the places I've spoken about my book recently.
Uh-huh.
So
yeah.
Next up, you. Or maybe we'll take world class on the road. But I think that's a really intriguing idea. And I think a real challenge for places like Stanford to think a little bit about how we should be more intertwined, engaged in our community. And when I say community, I mean not just locally, but nationally and maybe globally. So, terrific conversation. Thank you so much.
It was a lot of fun. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. If you like this episode, please review us on Apple Podcasts. It helps new listeners to find the show. And be sure to subscribe to stay up to date on what's happening and why in the world.